Well, it's good to be back with you. I don't know who thought it was a good idea to have three classes in 3 hours on three completely different topics, but that's what we're going to be doing. The first class will be more like Christian evidences kind of stuff. The second one will be more like practical Christianity, and the third one will be more like deep Bible teaching. So we're hitting all bases here. So therefore, this first one I'm going to have to do a little bit on the quick side. I don't know if you remember, but last night we had that quote from Dallas McCown where he said, Christianity is scientifically insupportable and historically fraudulent. And so I want to talk a little bit about the claim that the Bible and Christianity, but specifically the Bible, is historically fraudulent. That's easy to say. Now, I would wager to say that probably Dallas McCown hasn't actually read the Old Testament. He might have. I don't know the guy. I would guess if he has at all, he's read in just little snippets written by people who hate Christianity, hate God, and are looking for reasons to not believe in the Bible. But I don't know that for sure, to be honest with you. It's possible. And by the way, speaking of those 500 eyewitnesses, there's another famous religion in America, and they had three eyewitnesses. You know the one I'm talking about? And all three of them apostated from that church. So that's a nice comparison. You know the church I'm talking about. And there's a book on that religion on the, there on the back table if you want to read that. All right, so let's think about it before we start. Now, because we have to ask, if the Bible is an accurate historical record, then what would we expect to find? There's too much on that slide. I'm afraid I need to cut it down. The period of the patriarchs, the period of slavery, the period of the Exodus, the judges, the United Kingdom, the divided kingdom. Where in the timeline of the story of God's people, where in the timeline would you start to find actual things you could dig up out of the ground and say, this should be able to reflect something we'd see in the Bible? Where would you find that? Yeah, during the period of the United Kingdom. So before the United Kingdom, you would not expect to find buildings. You go, obviously. So before the time of David, do not expect to find archaeological proof. So if you were to go to Egypt, what would you find? Nothing? Or maybe some remnants of huts? You know, a pre- United Kingdom, if the Bible is accurate history, then what you should find is evidence of a cultural nature, of a linguistic nature, of legal systems, things like that, that reflect the things in the Old Testament. For example, if the Bible is reliable, then the book of Genesis should reflect the culture of Mesopotamia, roughly 1,800 BC. And the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy should reflect the cultural setting of Egypt around 1400 BC. And then the book of Judges should reflect what we know culturally, similar to Egypt, of course, of Palestine around, 1200 to 1000 BC. And then you should start to see actual physical remains that tell us things about Judea and Israel after that. And by the way, that's exactly what you find. All right? Now, of course, there are places you can go to. For example, in Genesis, it has Abraham living in Ur. And the biblical picture is Ur is a wealthy, vast city that Abraham left the place of culture and wealth and everything to wander in the wilderness. And sure enough, Ur, 2000 BC, was perhaps the largest city in the ancient world at that time. And then Abraham went from there, and he went to Haran. And you get the sense that Haran is a smaller city, kind of the wild, wild west, kind of out on the edge of things. And sure enough, oh, where's my thing on Haran? Yeah, there's Haran. And Haran is a city that was abandoned around 1600 BC. Now, the skeptics of the Bible say these stories, Genesis was written, 500 or 600 BC, a bunch of stories that people made. You know, these rabbis made it up just so they could make their children behave them and all these nice little stories like Aesop's fables. Well, interesting, And by 600 BC, this city had not existed for 1,000 years. All right, and I'm guessing the cultural memory of the city of Haran, there was no cultural memory. And yet, the Bible records this city of Haran. There's an interesting scene in Genesis where Laban is the father, and it's Rachel and Isaac. And Isaac, he's trying to get a wife. Jacob. And first, he gets Leah, and she's not, what can we say, not quite as attractive. So he has to wait for 7 more years. And then he gets Rachel, who's quite attractive. He gets her for 7 more years. And then he leaves. And then Laban chases him across the desert. And finds him and says, "Give me back my household idols." Yeah. All right. That's a weird story. But they found an inscription in ancient Babylon that says, "Whoever possesses the household idols gets the inheritance." And again, so what that shows is things in the Old Testament, things in the book of Genesis representing cultural phenomena that only make sense in Mesopotamia around 2000 BC, the time of Abraham. Another interesting one is the Ebla tablets. And the Ebla tablets, Ebla is a city actually fairly close to Haran. It's in the region in northeast Syria where ISIS is in control right now. And it was a large city, and they found a stockpile of 30,000 cuneiform tablets. And some of the names found on those tablets include Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai. Now, those are not referring to the biblical figures. The chances that the case is virtually zero. What that means is those were common names. Where? In Mesopotamia. When? Between 2000 and 1800 BC. Now imagine you're reading a letter and somebody says, this letter is, from somebody, 2 years ago from LA. And the names on there are like Ruth and Harold. And you go, this doesn't make any sense. All right? And so, again, like I said, before the time of David, if you're going to find evidence supporting the historical accuracy, or not supporting it, of course, then it would have to be these kinds of things. Okay, let's go forward here. How about the Genesis 14:2? Genesis 14:2 describes a battle between Abraham and Lot and the 5 kings that occupied the 5 cities in the Dead Sea region, fighting a battle against Chedorlaomer, this king from Elam. All right, and of course, those who don't believe the Bible have for, hundreds of years have been laughing, ha, 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 Dead Sea, cities in the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is one of the most desolate places on earth. I was there just the summer before last, and I mean, it is absolutely desolate. And essentially, it's been unoccupied throughout all recorded history, as far as they knew. But then in the 1980s, some archaeologists thought, I don't know, let's just check. Maybe, who knows? Who knows? And what they found out is, around 2000 BC, the area was quite dry and quite hot. However, there were a number of wadis. These are these seasonal rivers. But the evidence is, 2000 BC, they were not seasonal rivers. I remember flying over Peru. And Peru is not a very beautiful place, not really. It's kind of ugly. And, I mean, it's kind of, in fact, it's not that different from the area around the Dead Sea. It's just total desolate desert. But you have these ribbons of green. And those are the rivers that come out of the Andes, and there's fairly intense farming based only on irrigation and nothing else. So what they found was around 2000, somewhere between 2200 and 2000 BC, they found, guess how many cities? 5. Not 4, not 6, 5 cities. All right, and also what they found was there was evidence of intense agriculture. You know how the Bible describes, Abraham said, no, you can have the good land down by the Dead Sea. I'll take the bad land up there in the mountains around Judah. And if you look at the modern context, you go, okay, if you say so. All right? And interesting, in Bab-ed-Drah, that's what they call it, which is the largest of the five, they found ashes up to 5 feet thick. The evidence is all five cities were destroyed by fire somewhere between 2,200 and 2,000 BC and never occupied again. Indeed, the entire area was never occupied by significant population ever again after that time. So we have a smoking gun. That would be a gross overstatement, but we have significant evidence. Oh, yeah, there you go, smoking gun. Sorry for that. We have significant evidence of a miracle. Now, outside of Bab al-Dur, there was a graveyard. It was about a kilometer away from the city, and there were these little, like, wooden structures they'd built, I guess, as their mausoleums. And the archaeologist said the evidence was these buildings burned from the top to the bottom. Now, when you burn something down, how does it burn? Bottom to the top. So you see what we're talking about here. And people, of course, laugh at the Old Testament as if it's just a bunch of baloney and stories that are made up. So there are the five cities. The largest one, Bab-ed-Drah, is probably ancient Sodom. And there's some actual digs done in Sodom. A friend of mine actually went there and did some archaeological work. Now, again, there's the Hittites. The Hittites are mentioned in the Old Testament, I don't know how many times. I don't know the exact number of times. Something like 72 times the Hittites are mentioned, and there's the Uriah the Hittite. And there's Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Canaanites, and all these other uptites and whatever. And of course, up until the late 19th century, people sneered at this. These are obviously made-up stories. You know, who would make up such weird names? Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, you know, and you know, all these cities, whatever. Especially the Hittites. They especially went after the Hittites. Because clearly the Old Testament describes the Hittites as being a more influential culture than these Jebusites and all these other ites. And they said, you know, because we all know about Egypt and we all know about Babylon and Assyria, but the Bible describes this other group, the Hittites, that were kind of rivals with the two. And then in 1906, Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha. It was the capital of a large empire. It would be in central Turkey today. And sure enough, the Hittites were a very large empire. They peaked around 1600 to 1400 BC, just at the right time. Their capital city was Hattusha. This is the gate leading into the city of these people that the skeptics said didn't even exist. In fact, at Cambridge University, you can get a major in Hittite studies. So I don't know. I think it turns out trusting the Bible to be accurate history is a pretty good bet. Now, here's how these critics, here's how these skeptics go. And to be honest with you, history and archaeology is a subject where those who do it should be very skeptical and critical. It's the nature of the science. So to some extent, you can't blame them for taking that approach, because that's their job. All right? And yet, when they try to speak to the accuracy of the Bible, then they kind of seem to overstep their bounds, in my opinion. So here's what these people do. They'll say, oh, this is just totally bogus. Oh, this is just totally bogus. Oh, this is just totally bogus. And then you show physical evidence of this, that, and that. And they say, all right, fine. Well, this is totally bogus. And this is totally bogus. And this is totally bogus. And what they don't seem to notice is, yeah, but that, that, and that weren't. All right, and so that's what's going on here. So when you hear people saying, oh, there's no evidence for this and there's no evidence for that, you know, bear that in mind. I got a question on my website, I think, just the week before last. Is there any historical evidence for the Jews being in Egypt during the time of the supposed captivity? The answer is no. All right? There's a couple things you can point to, but I like to be very, very cautious, very conservative. So there's things you can point to that people use, but I feel like I'm not going to go there because it's something that it could be interpreted that way, but you know, I think we need to be honest with the evidence there. All right, so papyrus ebor, in fact, I'm not going to use that one. Here's an interesting one. This is from the Tel El Amarna letters. These were found in the city of El Amarna, which was built by Akhenaten, the interesting guy, the one who was worshiping the sun god and all that kind of stuff. And there's some evidence, biblical evidence, that the Jews might have actually helped to build that city. Now, I'm not saying archaeological evidence, but in these letters, these are a cache of letters from minor kinglets in the what we call Palestine, and one of them sent to Pharaoh said, "The Habiru plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of my king, my Lord, are lost." Hapiru. Hapiru, Hebrew. All right? So, is there archaeological evidence of the Jews having been in Egypt? I don't know of any yet. To be honest with you, I'd be almost shocked if anything was ever found there that could prove that the Jews were there. If it happened, awesome, but I don't expect to happen. But that seems like evidence to me. In fact, I believe that, in fact, the king did not send the archers. Or either way, even if he did, then there's all the stuff with the locust and the hail and all that stuff. Either way, we know what happened. All right, now, another point is, a lot of people say, obviously, this story about the conquest of Canaan did not happen because there's very little evidence from 1400 BC of mass destructions of the cities in Canaan. Therefore, obviously, the Jews did not conquer Canaan at that time. Well, there's a problem with that because if you look in the Old Testament, God said, do not destroy their cities. Rather, occupy them. In fact, it describes three cities that were destroyed and none of the others were destroyed. Those three were Hazor, Ai, and Jericho. Now, guess what cities we have solid evidence to have been destroyed roughly 400 BC? Jericho and Hazor. The identity of Ai is not sure at this point. Some people say it would be Bethel. The bottom line is we don't know what city Ai was. It was a smaller city anyway. And the Jewish archaeologists who studied Hazor called it the greatest destruction of all time. The destruction of Hazor, so that even rocks were melted at the time of the destruction of the city of Hazor, I believe by the Jews. When they studied Jericho, by the way, there's not, you know, the whole walls fell out thing and the supposedly Garst thing proved that, you know. Now, I think take that one with a little bit of grain of salt. But what they did find is that it was destroyed, Jericho, in the late Bronze period, from roughly 1400 BC, it was destroyed by fire. The fortification walls collapsed at that time. The destruction occurred at harvest time. And they know that because they found rooms full of grain that had been decomposed over time, which would be when the river was at its highest. The siege of Jericho was very brief because there was large amounts of grain stored in the city. And contrary to what was customary, the grains were not plundered. Now, if you know the story of the conquest and destruction of Jericho, that agrees with all the facts. Does this prove that Israel conquered Jericho at that time? No. But the point is, people say, the Bible is historically fraudulent. My response to that is, can you give me a single example? I'm saying, can you give me a single example of a thing that's recorded in the Bible which contradicts a known fact about archaeology or history? And the best that I know is there is none. What we have is these sort of things. And these skeptics, I guess they just don't notice it. I don't know. That doesn't impact them, which is interesting. The Stele of Merneptah, which specifically mentions the Israelites found in Egypt 1230 BC. Just mentions them in a list of nations. So apparently they were there at that time. All right. Let me see. I'm skipping some of my notes here. All right. The Moabite stone, so-called because it was found in Moab. It's in the Louvre now. And it mentions this guy named Ahab of the house of Omri. All right. And again, until this stone was found, those who try to claim the Bible is just a bunch of stories made up, their territory they can occupy keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. They don't notice this. All right, it's kind of like, I remember when I was in college, I invented this sport with my buddies of riding ice chunks on the river there in Connecticut. So we'd break off as big a chunk as we could, and we'd ride it down the river, you know. And what would happen is when you hit a rock, it would break up, and you had to jump onto the smaller chunk, you know, step there. And every time it gets smaller. And I think that's what these skeptics are doing. They're on this chunk, all this claims, all the Bible, blah, 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 keeps getting smaller. But the difference is they don't notice it. I remember when I was doing that, I noticed, boy, it's getting smaller. I better get off this thing pretty soon. I don't know. But I believe, of course, I believed it already because I believe the Bible is inspired by God. But now I believe not only by faith, but also by evidence. I believe also by evidence that, yes, there actually was a king named Ahab, and that he was the descendant of Omri, as recorded in the Bible. I think I actually believe that. I'll skip that. This one. The Tel Dan inscription. A good friend of mine, John Wilson, who's a professor of archaeology at Pepperdine University, he was in the city of Dan the day this was discovered. And it was not some kind of inscription on a wall in a city. Well, it sort of was. What it was is, generally they would rebuild the cities out of the old rocks. And this was just in some wall. There's this rock. And he said he walked by the very rock that same day. But it had to do with the angle. The sun had to be just at the right angle to say, oh, this thing is flat. There's an inscription on here. And of course, people scoffed. King David and killing Goliath, you know, conquering Jerusalem and all this stuff with, you know, Saul and, you know, whatever. The idea of the divided kingdom and Jeroboam and Rehoboam and all that stuff. All right. That's typical. And then they found the Tel Dan inscription from 820 BC, recording details in agreement with 2 Kings 8:28 through 29, where the king of Aram claims, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. So what this tells us is there sure enough was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom and an Ahab and a line of kings from Ahab and Jehoram, a line of kings going all the way back to David. Now, it's interesting because he says, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab. Now, the Bible story is slightly different. The Bible story says he was wounded in that battle. He left that battle and Jehu killed him. Now, let me ask you a question. This is an easy question. Which is the more believable story? Killed by the king of Aram or wounded by Aram and then later killed by Jehu? That's an easy question, folks. In every case, in every single case, when you investigate, you compare the biblical record to the record from another source. The biblical record is always more accurate. Always. Without exception. And these skeptics, they just don't notice this. Personally, I think they should. That's my opinion. All right, this is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. I was just there a couple months ago. You know, when I'm going into the British Museum, it's like, oh, it's so awesome. I mean, and so, anyway, this is King, I'm sorry, I've got to check my notes. It's embarrassing. I have to check my notes. Yeah. Sorry about that. Which king is it? That's terrible. I shouldn't have to. The Taylor Prison. Which king is bowing down? Isn't it Jehu? Yeah, it is. All right, it is Jehu. It's not even mine. It's Jehu. All right, so anyway, this guy here is Jehu, and he's bowing down. There he is there. He's bowing down to Shalmaneser. Now, one of the problems is people say, where are these statues and these inscriptions to the kings of Israel and Judah? And the answer is, there are none. Proof the Bible's not reliable history. That's not proof of anything. Because what did God say to the Jews about making statues of people? He said, don't do it. All right? And apparently, despite their worship of Baal and Ashtoreth and all that, apparently the Jews obeyed that because we have no statues, none of this stuff from the Jews in that time. And this is fuel for the fire for the skeptics who don't bother, I guess, to read the Bible and notice the obvious fact. Didn't they ever notice that not only are there no statues of King David, there's also no statues of anybody else because they didn't have those things. Except, of course, in because there were cities like Megiddo, which were occupied by the Egyptians during that time, as it says in the Bible. And that city has those things. The other cities don't. Anyway. So, I don't know. I think Jehu was a real dude. And by the way, the Old Testament does not record him going and bowing down to Sennacherib. But what does say is that he gave tribute to Sennacherib. And apparently, he actually brought the tribute to Sennacherib in person. Okay, here's the Taylor Prism. Looks like this big thing. In fact, I was there again in June. It's only about that tall. The writing is really tiny. It's pretty impressive. And so you can imagine guys chipping this whole thing out. I don't know why they wrote so small. But it has a story about Sennacherib. And Sennacherib destroyed the northern kingdom in 722. And then he came and tried to destroy Judah several years later, 691. And here's the inscription in the Taylor Prism, also known as the Sennacherib Cylinder. I don't know why they call it the Sennacherib Cylinder, since it's not cylindrical, but never mind that. Okay, here's the, obviously it's translated, obviously it's the quote. As to Hezekiah, the king of the Jews, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small, cattle beyond counting. Consider them booty. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in the cage. End of story. Now, what does it not say? That he conquered Jerusalem. The reason it does not say that he conquered Jerusalem is because he didn't conquer Jerusalem. The most powerful king in the world at that time surrounded Jerusalem with a massive army. And then the story stops there. Because, see, in all other ancient histories, they have victory after victory. Not a single king ever lost a single battle to anybody. Right? Oh, wait, there is one ancient record of a culture where they actually lost more battles than they won. And it's the only one. It's called the Bible. Again, the skeptics don't notice that. It's interesting. So I believe what we have here is strong evidence of a miracle in the Bible. In fact, both in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, I'm not going to call out proof. I don't think that's a reasonable statement. But we have a strong supported evidence to a biblical story, in one case of fire falling from heaven, another case of a massive army being destroyed in one night. I can't say evidence destroyed in one night. I'd say evidence of something that's hard to explain, which is that the greatest army at that time came to Jerusalem, and then the story ends right there. There's the Siloam inscription. 2 Kings 20 describes this interesting thing where they built this tunnel to bring water into Jerusalem, and it was preparation for the siege of Sennacherib. And then you can actually go to this very narrow cave, and it's something like 1,800 feet long. I don't know the exact thing. It's really long. And they began at one end, and they began at the other end, and they met in the middle. And there's an inscription there describing the ceremony when they met in the middle. So I don't know. I think maybe that story in 2 Kings about them building the tunnel to bring the water supply from the spring of Gihon. I think, yeah, maybe it did actually happen, since they have the inscription right there in the aqueduct that brings in the water, that still brings water. It's not used as a water source, but it's still there, and there's still water there. I don't know. I think maybe it did happen. Possibly. The Lachish Room. Now, in Jeremiah, it's Jeremiah 29. It says, I know the plans I have for you, the plans to give you hope in a future, and you'll come to me and call upon me, and it's going to be great and awesome and amazing if you seek me with all your heart. But we tend to read that a little bit out of context, because if you read on, he says, but the city's going to be destroyed, and you're going to be in captivity for 7 years. So when we say, God's going to bless you and it's going to be great, but you might have 70 years of captivity and it might be total devastation and destruction in your life, the prosperity gospel is not found anywhere in the Bible, I'll say that. But that's beside the point. That's a little preaching point there. But it does describe how, again, as Nebuchadnezzar was coming towards Jerusalem there, how he destroyed all the cities. And the last two were Azekah and Lachish, and then later on, Jerusalem. And they found a letter. These are some of the scenes from Lachish. This was found in Nineveh. And if you ever go to the British Museum, there's a whole room filled of these amazing bas relief. Those are Jewish. You can see they're Jews, the beards and all that. They're being led captive back from the destruction there, being led captive back. These are some other pictures of the slave drivers bringing the Jews back. This is a picture of them being flayed alive in front of the walls. So they would put the Jewish captives up there on these things, right in front of the people. They'd rip their skin off. It's pretty horrible. The Assyrians were not exactly nice people in the city in Lachish. But anyway, here's one of the Lachish letters from 588 B.C., roughly. And it reflects the events in Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7. Basically, the letter says, and the person who created this letter, it's written on a clay shard with charcoal. And the person who wrote this letter probably died within several hours of when he wrote this letter. And the letter obviously was never sent. And the letter said, we just saw the light in Azekah go out. And if troops are not sent within hours, we will be destroyed as well. And then sure enough, within a day or two of when this letter was written, Lachish was destroyed as well. We have the record of that from these ancient bas relief as well as from the Bible. So you know what, I think it did happen, and it kind of reminds us that when God says, when his people don't obey him, then he'll come and exact judgment on them. And the day of the Lord is not a happy day necessarily. We are hearing about the happy church and the happy God. God is happy when we obey him, but when we don't obey him, he's not so happy. All was prophesied by Isaiah 39. In Isaiah 39, which is a prophecy of how Babylon will rise up to be the dominant power and will come back and take everything away from them. That was written around 720-730 BC, around 150 years before the actual events. And he said, and some of your children will be taken as eunuchs to live in the palace in Babylon. The name of those eunuchs were Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were in fact made eunuchs. Do you hear about David, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's children? No, you don't. So these events were all prophesied in Isaiah 150 years before they happened. So not only is the Bible accurate history, it contains prophecies in itself of things that were fulfilled later on in the biblical record. I've got a whole bunch of other things. I think you get the general idea, all right? There's the story of Jehoiachin. Now, Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem three times. He came in 605, and there's little record of that in the Babylonian records. Some people say, well, obviously it didn't happen. All right, if you want to take that position, go ahead. All right, a lack of evidence is not evidence that it didn't happen. But then we have definite evidence of 597 and 586. And so in 597, he came and he took Jehoiachin. If you read in 2 Kings, he was blinded and taken off as a captive. But at the very end, it has this little thing, how he was treated well by the king in Babylon. And then what they found in the ruins of Babylon, they found, not that one, it's this one here. They found a record of the things that were given to the captive kings. And the record describes this guy, Joachim, king of the land of Judah, who was given 10 times more rations than any of the other captive kings. All right, so I think Joachim was Jehoiakim, was in fact taken as a captive. He was in fact taken to Babylon and was treated very well, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But it doesn't have to make a whole lot of sense, because if it's in the Bible, it's true. Okay, one more example. I'm going to do a lot of skipping. The Babylonian Chronicles, that's awesome. Oh, I'm sorry. This is that, you can even see, it looks like a table of numbers. This is the record of Joachim's, things he was given there. That is so cool that they found that. It's so cool. All right, my last one. Okay, in Daniel chapter 5, you have the record of this guy, Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. And that's the story of the writing on the wall. Herodotus says the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. Thucydides says the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. All the ancient historians said the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus, but the Bible says the last king of Babylon is Belshazzar. Again, everybody knows the whole thing about Daniel, the writing on the wall. What is, seriously, who can believe this actually happened? As proved wrong, because the Bible just records this king called Belshazzar, who was never even a king. Who's Belshazzar? All right? And then in Ur, this is back to the same picture, because we started in Ur and we're ending in Ur. In Ur, they found an inscription on the wall in the ziggurat there, and it explains what happened. What happened was, sure enough, Nabonidus was the last legitimate king of Babylon, but he took the throne. He was actually not legitimate. He took the throne by killing the king and by having a house coup. And then his son, whose name was Belshazzar, his son married the daughter of the wife of Nebuchadnezzar. So his son was a legitimate heir to the throne. So what Nabonidus did was he went off into Sin, literally. There's a city in the Arabian Peninsula called Sin. And he was off, he was into all this mystical whatever thing. And he basically, essentially, he left his son as a regent. In fact, his son, Belshazzar, ruled as regent for 17 years, governing almost all the affairs of Babylon. Now, if you go to Daniel chapter 5, he says, if anyone can read the writing on the wall, I will give him the third highest place in the kingdom. Ah! Why the third highest place? Again, the skeptics say, Belshazzar, who's he? And you have to understand that those who don't accept the Bible is inspired by God, they say the book of Daniel was written after 164 B.C., when Antiochus Epiphanes was kicked out of Jerusalem. Because obviously, the Bible's not inspired. So those prophecies in Daniel 11 and Daniel 7, those are obviously written after the fact. So obviously Daniel was written around 160 BC or so. Well, what was the going knowledge about Babylon at that time? Last king's name was Nabonidus. And yet Daniel has the Belshazzar, who was in fact the actual ruling king at that time for 17 years, offering the third highest place in the kingdom. So I'd say if you hear, you see on the internet all this stuff, can't believe the Bible, it's all a bunch of fairy tales. Oh, this the Cyrus Cylinder, I wish, oh, that's awesome. You can virtually read the Cyrus Cylinder in the book of Ezra, chapter 4, and there Pontius Pilate, who people said there was no Pontius Pilate. There's the Pilate inscription and all that sort of stuff. And the whole idea, the story about the crucifixion with the nail through the feet. Oh, then they found this. And the Pool of Siloam, not real. Oh, well, maybe it is real. All right, et cetera. So that's good enough.